I know y'all are thinking the same thing I am. What the heck with this economy, right? From American Public Media, this is MarketFlex. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, June the 3rd. Glad to have you along as always, everybody. We truly are. All right, I'm going to list a couple items here, newsy and otherwise. You put them in descending order of economic importance, all right? All right, here you go. American electoral politics, today's jobs report in all its measly 38,000 new jobs glory, the forthcoming Brexit vote in the UK, what Janet Yellen is thinking right now, and how about corporate America, just as a wild card there. Here to play along are Felix Salmon from Fusion and Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. Hey, everybody.
Hello.
All right, so Catherine, we'll stipulate that today's jobs report was lousy, stinking, terrible, no good, right?
It was pretty bad. I mean, there were some expectations that it would not be great because we had this Verizon strike last month,
yep,
which depressed the numbers. But even if you strip out what happened in telecom, it was still pretty lousy. A lot of people dropped out of the labor force.
Yep.
Hiring went down. Just a lot of bad news, basically.
So, Mr. Salmon, reconcile for me then how other parts of the economy seem to be doing all right. I mean, consumers are spending, retail is up. Help me out, man.
Right. So we've seen this quite a few times over the course of this recovery over the past 8 years or so, seven years, is that what the consumers do, what the economy as a whole does, is not directly correlated to hiring patterns. And sometimes the economy can go great guns with the jobs that it already has. And then sometimes once it has a bit of momentum, it starts picking up jobs. So you don't see the two entirely in lockstep. But the fact that people have stopped hiring, obviously that's bad news for all of the people who haven't got hired. And it's probably bad news for the economy as a whole.
It's also just 1 month. So
I don't
want to like send everyone into panic
last,
here.
But look at the revisions from last month and the month before that. They were down as well. Right?
They were down as well, but it's not like we're facing the apocalypse here.
No, that happens if Britain votes to leave the European Union.
You're skipping ahead of my list. Hold on, because I want to back up to this whole it not being all in consumers. Catherine, corporate America has a gazillion dollars in the bank. Their investment levels are in human capital are low. Is there anything to be done about that, or should we just deal?
I actually don't think they're doing so great either. I mean, if you look at the profits numbers, they have not been particularly stellar. Maybe partly because one of the few bright spots in the labor stuff is that wages have gone up, so that hurts companies, at least in the near term. So, you know, the companies are not doing so great either. And a lot of other economists that I've talked with have been pointing to that long before they started worrying about the job market itself. Mm.
And frankly, I'm not too worried about corporate profitability for exactly the reason that Catherine just gave, which is that if corporate profitability goes down because they're spending a bunch of what used to be profits on new employees and new jobs and increasing the wages of existing employees, that's exactly what we want.
Right, exactly. All right. A brief pass, Felix, by or perhaps through the mind of Janet Yellen. June rate hike, yay or nay?
No, no way.
All right. Catherine, same question.
Same answer.
All right.
I think a couple of weeks ago, it was on the table. But after today's jobs report, which, again, as we have established, was not good, and the lingering uncertainty about Brexit, which I know we're not supposed to bring up yet.
This is now the appropriate point in the discussion to bring that up.
Okay. But because that vote won't occur until after the next Fed meeting, it wouldn't make sense for them
thus adding to the whole uncertainty thing. Now, Felix, what do you think is going to – you don't get to vote, do you, by the way?
I've been in the U.S. for longer than 15 years, and that means I'm ineligible to vote.
And you are galled by that, I've read.
I am unhappy about this because I would vote remain in a heartbeat, as would any sensible, knowledgeable, or informed person.
However, one cannot assume rational actors on the part of the electorate. So how bad is it if they say, yeah, no, we're out of here?
It's really bad. I mean, it's really bad for Britain, it's really bad for Europe, and as Catherine implies with her statement about Janet Yellen, it's really bad for everybody. We have this long-term project of unity and coming together and free trade agreements, and the idea that the world is going to balkanize into these little national you know,
things, whatever, yeah,
things fighting against each other and considering the rest of the world the enemy is just terrifying.
Yeah, and it's not just a symbolic thing. I mean, you mentioned trade, obviously. Right. This would be devastating for the British economy, given trade agreements that are essentially hinging on their being a part of the EU.
Knowing
and
as immigra- I do,
and immigration flows and other things like that, other like actual economic consequences.
Britain is a small island. We need immigration, and the idea that we're going to sort of vote against it, vote to leave the European Union because we want less immigration. I mean, it's completely crazy, and the fact that we're even having a vote on this just boggles my mind.
All right, Felix Sammer from Fusion, Catherine Rampell at the Washington Post. It's your standard Friday chit chat. Thanks, you all.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks, Guy.
All right. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, not great. Not terrible, but not great. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Even after Felix and Catherine and five-ish minutes of talking about it, there is still a question or two to be asked about the jobs report we got this morning. Actually, there are a whole bunch of questions to be asked, but hey, it's only a half an hour program, so we are going to tackle this one. With the end of the Great Recession, as Felix mentioned, now almost 7 years in the rearview mirror, an important but often overlooked reality, by the way, what should we legitimately be expecting job creations-wise from this economy? From our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on that one.
Most of the economists I talked to today offered some version of 38,000? Nah, probably not right, including Nariman Baravesh at IHS.
The May number looks too weak. In other words, it looks like it's a bit of a fluke and there's some special factors.
But Baravesh is quick to acknowledge there has been a significant slowdown in the job market, what he calls payback for slowing economic growth overall. Consider, since March, we've added just 120,000 jobs a month on average. For the previous year, it was twice that. But Andrew Chamberlain at online job site Glassdoor thinks this is probably the new normal, with unemployment so low at 4.7%.
As the economy reaches full employment, we just don't need to generate as many jobs. To keep the unemployment rate steady, we only need about 90,000 jobs. People should start getting used to a jobs report closer to 100,000 new jobs rather than the 250,000 we maybe saw 2 years ago.
Andrew Stettner is at the Progressive Century Foundation. He warns if this is the new normal, it's going to leave behind a lot of folks who haven't seen much of a jobs boom yet. Discouraged and dropped out workers, part-timers, the long-term unemployed, teens, and new college grads.
What I'm concerned about right now is have we reached a point of treading water? Do firms kind of have the people they need to deal with the level of demand? You know, this is as good as what we get, but it feels very disappointing.
Now, Nariman Baravesh thinks this is more of a pause, and with the economy already rebounding, we could add 150,000 to 200,000 jobs a month again by later this year. If he's wrong, it's going to be a long, not very upbeat summer. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I don't know if you saw this, but there was a study out last month that said medical errors are the third leading cause of death in this country. 251,000 people every year, almost 250,000. In fact, more than 250,000. There is an experiment going on right now in New York, though, that could help put a dent in that somewhat frightening statistic. Mount Sinai Hospital has started treating certain patients at home. And from our health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports that early results suggest it might be working.
Daniel Enton lives in an apartment tucked above an art museum in Manhattan. Predictably, perhaps, it's crowded with paintings and knickknacks and books, too.
You can unwrap them yourself? Let me see.
A nurse practitioner from Mount Sinai checks in while the 89-year-old wrestles with his bandaged legs. Enton's got lymphedema, a condition for him that leads to sores and open wounds on his legs.
That's breaking down the dry skin.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Good. And you know you should wash them every day.
Yeah.
Someone in Enton's situation likely would have gone from the hospital to a skilled nursing facility. but he opted to get intensive rehab and nursing services from Mount Sinai staff at home.
I'm really old, and when I was a child, when I was feeling sick, I'd tell my mama. My mama would call the doctor, and the doctor would come to the house, right? So you're going to slowly creep your way back to that system, which existed 80 years ago.
Mount Sinai has launched a pilot to deliver hospital-level care at home to treat certain patients like Enton. 2 decades' worth of research shows that care at home is cheaper, and a person is 19% more likely to be alive 6 months after receiving treatment at home than in a hospital. Mount Sinai's Dr. Linda DeSherry says that's because in the hospital, patients can fall, catch so-called superbugs, or turn up their noses at the meals.
Many of our patients are frail elders. So when they're at home, they have their familiar surroundings, their own family, and their own food. All of that is tremendous.
Right now, hospital at home programs are limited largely because Medicare refuses to cover the service. But federal health officials are watching the Mount Sinai project closely. Early results suggest the hospital is cutting costs by 17%, reducing readmissions, and patient satisfaction is high. That said, bringing the hospital and all of its tools to the patients is a challenge.
This is a real paradigm shift in medicine, and people will often say on first glance, that sounds so great, that we should definitely do that. But, you know, when you really get into it, it is a totally different way of providing care.
There are logistics to navigate. As DeSherry's colleague points out, it's easier to order Chinese at midnight in Manhattan than to find a tank of oxygen after hours. And there's a human piece, too, as health officials consider duplicating this program. Back at his apartment, Daniel Enton says he's concerned.
Right now, they're teaching me how to care for myself, right? The nurse says, I'll show you how to dress your wounds. And I thought, well, I can hardly reach my feet at all, so how can I dress wounds on my feet? They gave me a taste of what is possible, but I don't know what's possible.
Here's the thing. If enough patients like Enton return to Mount Sinai within 30 days, the hospital stands to lose some federal money. But the more Mount Sinai spends keeping him healthy, the harder it is to realize savings. For this model to really take off, the hospital must know when people can take care of themselves and when they can't. It's a high bar with human stakes. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I could see it being viewed as like, oh, it's those city slickers just coming to take what's not theirs.
Ain't that always the way? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 31 points this Friday, a tenth percent, 17,807. The NASDAQ down 28 points, about a half percent, 49.42. The S&P 500 dropped 6 points, 0.3%, 2,099. For the week, the Dow off 0.3%. The NASDAQ gained about 0.1%. The S&P 500 basically flat. Financial stocks faltered today on that jobs report. Think about it. Interest rates. Citigroup down 3.3%. Bank of America off 3.5% today. Clothing retailer Gap put on 4.1% a day after announcing a 6% fall in sales. That was better than many analysts forecast. Thus, capitalism endured. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note, and listen to this, because this is what the market thinks is going to happen with the Fed. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.70% today. Yesterday at this time, 1.83%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You can get a kitchen sink at Walmart for as little as $45.48. That's with a discount of almost 18 bucks, by the way. I mention it because kitchen sink is a surprisingly apt metaphor for what humanity's biggest retailer is trying to do to boost its fortunes. Back in January, Walmart announced raises for more than a million people. In May, it said it's bringing back those in-store greeters. This week, it announced it's partnering with Uber and Lyft to test out grocery delivery in a couple of places. And it's going to re-up with that round emoji-looking smiley face thing that used to be the low-price sticker icon, if you remember that. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace has more on the company's everything-but-the-kitchen-sink attempt at a turnaround.
Confession. When I think of that smiley face, I totally think of that scene from Forrest Gump where Forrest accidentally invents the smiley face.
He wanted to put my face on a t-shirt, but he couldn't draw that well.
But Walmart, of course, wants you to see the yellow smiley and think fond, savings-y thoughts about Walmart. Mara Einstein, a professor of media studies at Queens College, thinks it's a funny move and not funny ha-ha.
I question the smiley face one because it's such a dated imagery.
She says to compete with companies like Amazon, Walmart can't be retro. It needs to become a name in the digital and delivery world. And at the same time, she thinks Walmart's good old low-cost image has been damaged by protests over wages. But what exactly should the company's new face be? That's clear as mud.
It's really hard to be everything to everybody because then you end up being nothing to nobody.
Still, Walmart's shareholder meeting today was a bit of a pep rally, coming off of a stronger quarter than the company's had in a while. CFO Brett Biggs addressed the crowd in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
We've had 7 straight quarters of positive comp sales and 6 straight quarters of positive comp traffic.
Here's Forrester analyst Sucharita Mulparu.
I wouldn't say it's quite a comeback, but it's definitely a better story than it had been for a while.
Next up in the comeback effort, Walmart's testing out drones to work in its warehouses. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
All right, quick. What is the one thing businesses hate more than anything else? You might be tempted to say taxes here or government regulation, and neither of those would be wrong. The answer I'm looking for, though, is uncertainty, the not knowing about taxes and government regulation and when or where they might hit. And you don't, arguably, get much more uncertain about the direction of things than in a presidential election. Nicholas Bloom is a professor of economics at Stanford University. He studies this kind of stuff. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
When you are looking at things like uncertainty, I guess in capitalism writ large, but specifically around elections, what are your indicators? What do you look for?
We've been measuring the news, in fact. So we've been looking at the frequency of newspaper articles that mention the word economy. They mention uncertainty, and typically also look for policy words like the Federal Reserve or regulation or Congress. And we've been tracking that in the U.S. for about 100 years, in fact, going back over many decades in newspapers and in a number of other countries like the U.K.
And how does it manifest itself? I mean, are we talking volatility in stocks and bonds and you know, all the rest?
Well, what we've seen is when the newspapers are talking a lot about uncertainty, you see the stock markets are much more volatile. So stock prices are jumping up and down on a daily basis. Investors definitely take notice and they get nervous. And we also tend to see investment drops and employment drops. So businesses are cautious and, you know, they see uncertainties going up and they don't know what's going to happen. They tend to pause investing and hiring. So there's also a real cost to the economy of increased uncertainty.
Give me sort of the relative uncertainty importance of a presidential election versus like a decision by the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates or maybe not. We don't know what Janet's going to do, right?
So when we've looked back over the last 30 years, we've seen 2 presidential elections that have spiked policy uncertainty in our newspaper index. It was the first Clinton Bush Sr., and then Bush Jr. versus Gore. And there were marginal elections, and in both cases, it was the new candidates coming to the election. I think in the case of Trump, it will just be a magnitude larger because he's never held political office before. I think the closest comparison would be something like global collapse or Brexit in the UK. So the UK right now is having the Brexit vote on June the 23rd, and the policy uncertainty index there has spiked to all-time highs.
The election will happen on the 8th of November. That much we know. How, and we will have then certainty in theory anyway. How long will it take for things to settle down, do you suppose?
So I don't think with Trump we'll have certainty again, even if he wins. So I think in terms of the worst case scenario for uncertainty, he's ahead in the polls, he wins, and then it takes, you know, 6 months, a year for his policies to become clear. So we could have a big black cloud of uncertainty holding back the economy really from, you know, later this year and well through into next year as it takes time to to find out what he really is going to do in terms of policy.
And with Secretary Clinton, it would, in theory, be a shorter period of recovery?
Yes, I think Clinton's just much more predictable. She's been in office before. She's had a long political career. So I don't think there's nearly as much uncertainty about Clinton. I don't know, for example, whether businesses would actually prefer Clinton or Trump. I think what they like is certainty.
Nick Bloom at Stanford University, where he teaches economics. Nick, thanks very much.
Great. Thank you.
A story now from the Marketplace Crime Blotter Natural Resources Division. It's about water and the Great American West. People around here don't kid about their water. And in Colorado, there's been a rash of illegal activity manifesting itself mostly in urban backyards. So we dispatched Luke Runyon from KUNC and Harvest Public Media to check it out.
Just pulled up to the house. Looks like a pretty normal neighborhood. Let's go see what they got inside.
I walk up the driveway of this ranch-style home in Fort Collins, Colorado, to meet with one of the criminals. Her name's Katie Abrams. We move to the backyard to see what she's hiding.
It's behind there in that little makeshift wooden contraption that we've put around it.
We open the wooden box and take a peek at the contraband. It's a blue and white 50-gallon plastic rain barrel. Yep, a rain barrel. In Colorado, a drum to collect the rainwater that falls off your roof has been against the law. This illegal barrel is doing covert operations. It waters flowers in the front yard.
How many gallons does this even hold?
I want to say like 40 or 60. I have no idea. I'm no good judge of those kinds of things, but not a lot.
She moved with the barrel from Illinois. Without having a clue, she was smuggling illegal cargo across state lines.
Water's a big concern out here in the West, and thinking would be encouraged here to find out that actually it's illegal was kind of shocking.
Drew Beckwith is used to hearing that sentiment. He oversees urban water policy at the Colorado-based conservation group Western Resource Advocates.
The general argument is that if you're taking rain that doesn't belong to you, you're stealing from somebody else.
That's right. The rain that falls on your house doesn't belong to you, according to Colorado law. And that goes all the way back to the state's frontier beginnings, an idea enshrined in the state constitution. Water rights in the arid West are divvied up based on when you purchase them. If you hold a long-standing water right, you're entitled to it, even if you're a farmer further downstream and nothing, not even a tiny rain barrel, should be able to take it from you.
I could see it being viewed as like, oh, it's those city slickers just coming to take what's not theirs.
There is an impact. We know that there's an impact.
That's Republican State Senator Jerry Sonnenberg. He's from a mostly rural district on the state's eastern plains. He says by holding rainwater, the barrels could undermine the entire system used to deliver water to cities, farmers, and factories.
Anybody that does simple math knows that if you have 10 gallon and you hold up another gallon to use somewhere else where it normally wouldn't have been used, that is a change to the math and how that goes down the river. The question is how much of an impact is that?
Drew Beckwith isn't worried about the impact. The amount of water that's stored in a barrel is so small. Beckwith says they should be allowed. He and other environmentalists tried to legalize the barrels last year, but the bill failed in committee. Finally, this year, it came to a vote and the barrels prevailed. Come August, they'll be fully legal.
You can have one or two rain barrels and you can stick them underneath your downspout.
But it may still take a few more months for rain barrel scofflaws to feel comfortable enough to come out of the shadows and water their flowers without looking over their shoulders. In Fort Collins, Colorado, I'm Luke Runyon for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Google is working on self-driving cars, as you probably know. They are also apparently working on self-honking cars, which kind of makes sense. The company wrote in its most recent update of the Google self-driving car project that it's teaching its cars when to honk, when to just give a little toot, and when to really lean into it. Their goal, they say, is for their cars, and this is a quote, to be polite, considerate, and only honk when it makes driving safer for everybody, which they just really, they don't get the whole honking thing then, do they? All right, there you go. Another week in the books. The Dow off 31 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ down 28 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 lost 6 points, 0.3%. Blame, if you like, the American labor market. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.